All right, this is Cameron and Bob again. This is our 20th session, and it's being recorded on April 1st, 2021. All right, now Cameron and I are, after 19 sessions or so, we're going to tackle the text that I produced many months ago. I say at the beginning, after featuring these two quotes that we covered last week, the road to understanding media, the road to understanding media effects begins with arrogant superiority, and pollster activities are all espionage, snooping on publics, and politicians all have conflicts of interest. So I said,
like everybody else.
Yes. I'm making a Marsh McLuhan kit of quotations nobody knows about, that he said to get out of this cul-de-sac of 50 stuff that they repeat ad nauseum. For example, the medium is the message, Global Village, media ecology, and the tetrad. And I said later to Cameron, I'm using McLuhan quotes and information that nobody uses. So what do I start with? Get the two quotes, then there's another quote, the third quote, 1959.
Right.
This means that we are increasingly, says McLuhan, insisting upon a do-it-yourself world, whether in decision-making or in consumer goods, and that on the overall pattern of social life, we are retribalizing after centuries of detribalizing, and that whereas we accomplish detribalization by literacy and segmental analysis of all thought, action, and production, we are accomplishing our retribalization by the simultaneous, by the electronic, which tends to put us in a kind of auditory world or field of simultaneous sound in which the intuitive man takes precedence over the analytic man. Is there anything you would say about intuitive man? Or ask me about.
Well, this letter from May 1959 was actually a very important one. For one thing, it's the first time I know of that McLuhan mentioned the Global Village. And most people, when you read the McLuhan scholars, they nearly always say that understanding media was the first place he mentioned Global Village, 1964, but that's completely wrong. Secondly, this letter, which was written to a McLuhan Center executive, was basically a talk that McLuhan had given in Winnipeg, which is where he grew up, of course, and where he first went to university. I believe the letter is 4 or 5 pages in the published letters. So it's very long and very detailed. And in it, McLuhan was first saying to his hometown, and then was hoping through McLuhan's magazine to be able to tell the country what he was saying about the Global Village and about the sorts of things in the paragraph that you cite here on detribalizing and retribalizing. But as you point out in your book, the McLuhan Center executive didn't understand the letter, and nothing came of it. It was just one more example of McLuhan trying to communicate something that people have been trying to communicate for thousands of years and have never been able to communicate at all. So here we are.
Right. The reason I selected this quote was to quickly summarize familiar aspects of McLuhan, retribalizing, detribalizing. It was a good quote. And the simultaneous is a meaning for the electronic, substitutable.
Right.
point there. So it was a good little section to quickly get through the sort of semi-known parts of McLuhan, then get to, I don't want to read everything I write here, but the guy wrote back, I don't know what the hell you're talking about. Oh, and now this is McLean. Hunter is McGraw-Hill publishes his book in 64. Did he get anywhere with McLean Hunter other than 10 years later, Peter Newman would interview him often?
Right. So McLean's magazine, for those possible auditors who aren't Canadians, is the most popular magazine in Canada, I think you could say, and has been for a great many years. So McLuhan was attempting to interest McLean's in what he was talking about in 59, and as you just said, he didn't succeed for another decade in actually doing so. But in the 1970s, when nobody was interested in McLuhan anymore, then McLean's got interested in
it. Well, Peter Newman did. He was smart enough to keep up on McLuhan's less known writings, and he knew McLuhan was saying new stuff.
Right.
So he wanted to get it out there. And that's to his credit.
Absolutely, absolutely. I don't know that he understood McLuhan. What he did was he understood that there was something going on there that was newsworthy.
Yeah, that was beyond what McLuhan, the cliches were about McLuhan.
Yeah.
In other words, you needed to hear the later stuff to understand what he really meant by the early stuff.
Yeah, but remember that he was also, two sort of contrary processes were going on at the same time. On the one hand, McLuhan was constantly learning and constantly trying new ways of communicating, constantly finding new ways of saying what he wanted to say. But on the other hand, he was also getting sick, or more sick, all the time, and sort of running out of energy and running out of patience. So increasingly, towards the end, he compares his work to comedy, and compares himself to a stand-up comic.
Yes.
So there's these, you could say there's three processes going on. There's what you just mentioned, the restating and clarifying of what he had said before. So you could, in that sense, you could say talking about the same. Then he was changing his approach, changing his skit, changing how he was attempting to communicate. So in that sense, he was doing something different and conceivably better. And then there was the whole health thing, which was conceivably working to the worst.
Mm. Okay, so moving down, say, I want to show basically a summation quote of McLuhan in the 50s. I said that. Good summation.
When you get into doing it yourself, which is very, very important for the cul-de-sac, because if there aren't standards of reality, of morality, of truth, if everything we see, everything we do, everything that we think is important is just something of doing it yourself, then, as Yeats said, the center doesn't hold, and things begin to disintegrate. And so there's this sort of dual emphasis in McLuhan in the whole question of making. On the one hand, that humans have always made, because when humans first use language, in a certain way, they're making the world they're making themselves. So it's a tremendous power. But after hundreds of thousands of years, that power has begun to disintegrate. If we no longer make sense of making, if that kind of circle comes back and eats its own tail, you could say.
Okay, well, my first point is something I wrote in spring 2017 after Trump got elected and he was just starting to be president. I say, how President Don Trump has become the first executive political leader to put on the shamanic tradition. So I know people would not think Trump is a shaman. No way. But I was trying to point out that he was doing something that was new that might have been shamanic just by the fact that he took over the Twitter and went around the TV candidates and won that way. So he was working with an environment that others weren't used to yet or even considering. So that's a new kind of techno artistry. So then I wanted to show, since people were criticizing Trump for character every day, I thought, okay, let's bring in McLuhan's point. There are two schools of art. And that's what I lay out. And I thought, that's a really neat thing to bring in. No one even knows about these two schools of art that McLuhan, you know, built his work around at the beginning in the early 50s. So should I read it, read a section, or just say that's what it is and the listener can look at the quote? But there's the moral view of art, which is cathartic and ethical, and then there's the cognitive. And the cathartic, ethical, moral view did not have an interest in popular art, the low arts, the popular folklore that was happening in the early 50s. So I said that Trump was somebody engaged with the whole cross-section of society, like the cognitive artist. And you shouldn't put value judgments on him, ethical questions. You're going to miss what he's going to do. And he did manage to keep upsetting people's cognition of him, and none of the moral accusations caught him, did anything to him. So I was very proud to throw this into the McLuhan world. I thought, nobody knows this quote other than Cameron, and it's a clever way to bypass the normal outrage about Trump's moral character. So what do you think of that? Do you like what I did
there?
Let
me just make a few comments that will, on the one hand, try to enlarge in what you're saying, and on the other, will try to kind of agree with the general tenor here of your thought. First, when you talk about the shamanic tradition, one of the problems is that not only have people not thought much about anything that we're talking about here, but especially they haven't thought about the shamanic tradition, right? So if somebody says Trump falls into the shamanic tradition, this is surprising because people only have one view of Trump, and that is sort of the unethical buffoon. They haven't done the necessary background work in order to focus what you're talking about, right? They haven't thought about the shamanic tradition. And then if we come to the quotation that you've got here, we have to note that the critique of the moralistic view of the world goes back to Nietzsche.
Yeah.
And what's being said here is that the moral view of the world is only a view. And it's very unusual for people, when they take a moral view of the world, to admit that other views are even possible, right? It's part of the moral view of the world to insist that it's the only correct view, and there's something wrong with people that don't have it,
yeah,
right? Because simply because it is moral, right? And so, because it's the point of view and the appreciation that everybody should have, then popular art and uneducated people are rejected by it.
Yeah.
Right? Everybody should be educated in just the same way as I have been educated. And what I see is this kind of morality at work in the world, and everybody should see that. And if they don't, I'm going to re-educate them. I'm going to re-clothe them. I may even take their children away so that they can be educated away from their buffoon family.
So the moral view leads to social engineering?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's social engineering isn't possible unless you have some great vision of how the world should be.
Yeah, and that's part of his ancient quarrel in modern America in the middle 40s. The social engineers are the dialecticians versus the ones who look at what is, the rhetoricians and the grammarians. So
right.
It's the same, and the cognitive, it's the same dialectic here.
Sort of. The moral view of the world could be explicated, you know, by rhetoric or even by grammar, and certainly by dialectic. So it's not the case that the moral view of the world is just associated with one kind of exercise of mind.
Yeah.
But it is true. He says in this quotation that the artist is not a reader of radiant signatures on the materia signata, but the signer of a forged check, right? And that's in the moral view.
Yeah.
Right? So what McLuhan is saying is that the artist should be a reader of the radiant signatures, and he should not be a signer of a forged check. And the signer of the forged check is really the romantic artist.
Yeah.
The romantic who tries to archetypalize a certain moment in time as being peculiarly significant, as some sort of significant moment that everybody should pay attention to.
That's the signer side?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That's the signer of a forged check.
On our hopes and sympathies.
That's right.
So the cognitive is the studying the effects.
Yeah, it's relating the it's relating anything really to a wider context. It's refusing to capture everything in a moment of significance. It opens up anything to look at its effects, to look at its causes, to look at what other causes could be there.
Yeah, so I once heard him say in a Monday night seminar to somebody, Nietzsche studied the effects. This fits into what you're saying about Nietzsche in your recent blog about nihilism. Nietzsche is very similar to McLuhan, or McLuhan recognized the depth of Nietzsche's cul-de-sac and is taking on, perhaps even hoping to get what Nietzsche didn't get.
Yeah.
This is the cognitive view. Okay, so
right.
So I lay
just,
that out.
Before we move on, let's just look at the last phrase, the cultic toilet.
Yeah.
That you bring up there. I mean, we're existing in the cultic toilet right now, right? It's the the whole idea that the truth has been seen by the great moralists in Washington, and they're going to reveal that great truth for the rest of us is exactly the cultic toilet.
Yeah, the McClellan in this period in the early 50s was looking at the cults of science and art and the different factions. And so the cultic toilet is from Joyce.
Yeah.
And it's referring to the Celtic twilight. But when you have the cultic instead of Celtic, McClellan means the cults. And it's actually the basis of secrecy is not viable anymore. Everything is collectively conscious and exposed. So it's the end of the cults of Machiavelli or whatever management and social engineering games elites are trying to do, trying mm-hmm. to put on the people. I had never thought of it that way. What do you think of that? The cultic, the end of the cults of science
sure, well,
and art.
Everything is exposed as cult.
Yeah.
Everything is exposed as being unoriginal, as being some sort of, as McLuhan says here, it's nescience. It is an example of not knowing.
Mm.
And that's why the twilight in Ireland that Yeats was leading and was kind of championing the Irish language and the Irish church and the Irish peasantry, that all of this was cultic because it hadn't thought through how this was to be interpreted in the widest possible way. Right? So when Joyce leaves Ireland, what he's saying is there's a wider world out there, folks. If you want to champion all this stuff, you got to do so in terms of the wider world.
Mm.
And until you do that, then these legends and all this stuff that you're championing is just cult work. And it's instead of being twilight, it's toilet.
Yeah. So let me see if I have something to say about why I picked the shamanic tradition. You know, they say, you know, Trump wasn't a politician. He was a businessman. Well, in modern techno society, often the successful businessmen, the giants, were like mystics of techne, and they became shamans in society, shamans of industry. But generally, nobody of that modern wizardry ended up in the White House. Eisenhower, military guy. FDR, politician. Wilson, a politician. Do you know of any? Is there anybody who was unique and not a politician before Trump?
No, you could say that what I liked about what you were just saying about the shamanic tradition and its relationship to the technology boys,
yeah,
is that in order to figure out how modern technology might be put to use and might generate wealth, what you have to do is you have to start with a particular technology and then kind of lower yourself into all of the workings of the human community and then find a way of applying the technology to those ways of the wider community below it.
Yeah.
And that's what Amazon has done and what Facebook has done, what Gates did with the operating system, et cetera. So politicians, in a certain way, had always been able to go into the crowd or go into the papers and take advantage of them. That's what made them powerful politicians. But with Trump, it seems like that process, number one, has been brought into the open, and number two, it's been satirized in a certain way.
By Trump.
Yeah, by Trump, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point, and I mean that, or I meant it. He also, if shamans are slightly tricksters, he's a trickster. I'm talking about the primitive shamans. McLuhan, Robert Fulford said that McLuhan was an Eskimo. That's a good guideline. And have you seen that article, some guy out of Quebec talking about McLuhan in the centenary 2011? No, it wasn't him. It was another guy that you and I couldn't figure out who he was or where he was from, who said that Trump probably read Playboy interview in March 69 with McLuhan and instinctively picked up some of the trickster aspects that McLuhan seemed to be implying in his own approach. Do you remember that essay? Did I send that to you?
That rings a bell with something that Clinton put up.
Yeah.
I didn't bother to read it. I don't read any secondary literature whatsoever. But I think something like that is in there.
Right. So Trump picked up on the media wizardry instinctively, and the thesis of this guy is that Trump applied McLuhan, or at least a vulgar version of McLuhan, in terms of getting an advantage over the media environment that he was growing up into in New York City. So those are the aspects I was thinking of when I said shamanic. You could even say, you know, the Manipian tradition. Manipian satire over the last 1,000 years is a response to new technical environments. That's why Manipian satire changes each phase. That was Eric McLuhan's thesis. So I'm continuing. What I have here is me explaining to somebody what the words meant, the proper quotations or precise paragraphs I would write. Then I wanted to have an oral, casual, almost sloppy explanation of it. So I was, you'll see the quote, that's supposed to be pretty outrageous. Nobody thinks Trump's a shaman. Nobody thinks he's even human or he has any intelligence. But the important point is, I knew you could not apply ethics to the Trump administration. That was not an issue anymore. And there were lots of reasons why that we're going to get into. But forget the ethical view, which is all that we have in the CNN world, the outrage of Trump's lack of ethics. They can't keep up with the more charismatic cognitive style of art that Trump does. That's why I'm calling him a shaman, expressing percepts over concepts. So by almost saying the same thing in a conversational way, I'm making sure that people get what I'm saying, because a lot of people read McLuhan as too opaque. They don't have a clue how to do it. But if you actually were visiting McLuhan at the coach house, he would explain things, you know, quite easily. You might find it hard to understand when you read it, but back then his style was a new kind of writing, it seemed. So people now can read McLuhan easily, but for some reason they had a big problem back then. So what do you think of the way I run over the same stuff conversationally?
Yeah, I would say that one of the questions that you're generating is Trump consciously doing this stuff as a kind of manager, or is he unconsciously or mostly unconsciously living out something else? Where McLuhan gave us good clues about how to read this something else.
Definitely he's not conscious. But that's what's most of us aren't conscious the way we live today. We haven't got time to become conscious or even figure out which is the right way. And that's intuitive man.
Yeah, absolutely. That gets back to the quotation that you had from the McLean Hunter's guide.
Yeah,
good point.
Yeah. And so Trump, the world had not been able to articulate what was going on for decades. But definitely after 9-1-1 and after the 2012 Mayan projection, so many things that people were waiting for. The Christians thought something would happen in 2000, or the fundamentalist Christians say. So much had been stripped away, and that we were winging it after the crash of 2008, that Trump actually, he got in because he knew how to wing it. And do you know that what he did is that he allowed, you know, his M1 money category or money supply, and then the M2, he decided to let the dope dealers dump their money into the economy and not be taxed. They'd all been hiding before that. That was pretty outrageous, but that created the abundance of circulation during his first 4 years. So he was really... Now, there is not being ethical, so to speak, allowing the dirty money of the black market to be part of the white market, say, was pretty original. And then you're going to see
Let
that...
Let me just say, Bob, that one of the sort of key background moves that you're making with the book... is it, in effect, you're saying, look, somebody can't become the president of the United States, the most powerful position in the world, by accident. It's something that needs to be understood. And then you say, we certainly can't understand it by saying he was an immoral idiot, end of story.
That's right.
That's to say he did become president by accident or something, right? That's why you need something like Russian collusion or something to explain it. But that's not to think, obviously. If we want to think about Trump, we have to think about the forces that he represented, the forces that perhaps outside of his consciousness and outside of his managerial ability, forces that were realized in his election and in his presidency. And so in order to do that, what you have to do in the book and what you attempt to do in the book certainly is you say, well, we have to look at these things in a different way. We have to get our thought out of its usual ruts and try to understand the Trump phenomenon as something that speaks to us and speaks of the age in which we're living.
The ground.
So then you bring in Trump, and then you bring in the idea of getting away from some kind of ethical evaluation of the process, and say that it needs to be understood conceptually. It needs to be understood as a cognitive, as something going on at the cognitive level, put it that way.
Right. Now, I've run through all the presidents. I don't know if I did it for you many episodes ago, but I go back to Eisenhower and then Kennedy and Nixon. I run through how each one is so appropriate for their time. In retrospect, you can see those guys were meant to be president for that period. And Trump is an example of the latest version of that. He was so perfect for what was really needed to be communicated to from the White House to the American people. And it wasn't just a political thing. There's something about the White House, which is the tuner of the sky for the world environment, that the occupant has to be appropriate. So, and that's, I'm repeating what you were trying to say, that Trump was very appropriate for his time, as every president was in their period.
Mm-hmm.
You know, after the orgy of Web 1.0, 93 to 2000, then the crash of the dot-com crash, there was an exhaustion. And therefore, you had to have this tired, empty guy, George Bush Jr., you know what I mean, who didn't engage in information, didn't read the papers, didn't want to be informed. It was so appropriate to have him after the hyper-informed Gore and Clinton team. So Trump was so appropriate for and if you think after the crash of 2008 – and the whole world is now involved in what McLuhan called the pre-litter societies. Everybody was bound by scarcity and hardship. There wasn't the rich-poor split of the, say, Gutenberg galaxy. Everybody shared in the problem. So there was a tough way of getting out of the crashed economy of 2008 and 2009. And there's all kinds of theories and movies trying to explain the way the economy got going again and where did the money come from. But everybody was sharing it, and so an image showed up that everybody could get involved in, and that was the charisma of Trump. He got people voting who hadn't voted in decades, supposedly, right? So he brought in HCE at a new level. And it was the time when it was needed. And that may explain why that election we just had was so intense for people and so polarized, because everybody is involved now. Everybody feels that they have a stake in how this turns out, because it's getting pretty bad what we're doing, or pretty ineffective. So he was a good crisis actor. The fact that he was seen as so unqualified to do it. There was a couple of points you were saying that made me think, yeah, what did McLuhan say? He predicted an actor would become president, and that was Reagan. But there were some other aspects of Trump that I was thinking that matched what McLuhan predicted was necessary. But I can't remember them right now. When you were talking 5 minutes ago.
Well, one of them is that McLuhan, like Nietzsche, kind of predicts what might be called the romanticization of the world. And that relates to the quotation that you had, the letter from McLuhan to the Hunter guy.
The 1959 letter.
Yeah. So you have, we are increasingly insisting on a do-it-yourself world, whether in decision-making or consumer goods, et cetera, et cetera. When Trump had his TV show and was constantly firing people, Trump was living out was this idea that our thinking in the modern world, because it has no foundation, is always a kind of executive decision. Everybody has become an executive of the world they live in. And, of course, below that, there's nothing, right? Although everybody has become what McLuhan called a skyjacker, which is a skyjacker in McLuhan's terms is a hijacker of reality.
Yep.
Right? And everybody has become the executive of reality. And when everybody's the executive of reality, there is no reality.
That's right. There's no executive either.
No, that's right. And so
the executive is dropout.
That's
completely
correct.
Dropped out.
Yeah. And so you would think that Trump was the opposite of some of these things, but he was the picture of them if once he is looked at in these other ways.
Yeah. And he was a dropout through all phases of business life. You know, the crude interpretation was this guy was a liar and a failure at everything he did and stole. No, he just dropped out to the next situation. And he dropped out of that. And they even thought he was not going to drop out of the White House if he lost. But he dropped out of that. They missed the dropout aspect of him. He's every man, or every human, every chemical body up against this ridiculous thing. And this is going to lead to the tech body, right? It's going to lead to another level of Trump. When I say shaman, I did say techno-shaman, but there's stuff coming here that I'm trying to lead to that I haven't said yet in my description, that the shaman angle might have to be dropped.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah. But that was what I said in 2017. So now I'm trying to update that 3 years later in 2020.
Uh-huh.
Let's see.
But doesn't this relate to the HCE aspect?
Yes.
That Trump, by being everything that's wrong, exposes aspects of HCE that we need to bring into our consciousness in order to appreciate where we're at. The whole moral view of the world is to reject stuff that is a part of who we are.
And that's why we come to the next part. This book that I cite, done by two Torontonians. I knew them at CKLN in the 80s and 90s. One of them was a DJ, and the other was a friend of Dave Neufeld, who I was hanging out with, and Dave made the Bob's Meteorology album. But Scott Woods, he and his buddy put together this incredible book called Unshackled, The Dustbin of Donald Trump. Now, all that we've just said about Trump, and maybe even the nihilism aspect, is in this book. So what they do, they ransack pop culture from the 60s on, every kind of character, every kind of odd movie, every kind of weird phenomenon, you know, from Ross Perot, say, across the culture. And it's a great inventory of everything. And so Donald Trump was the completion of all these attempts. Did you ever see the movie Bob Roberts? I think that's what it was called. I'm just naming one. You don't know that one. Okay.
No.
But the thing is, the dustbin of Donald Trump is already here before he's president, because it includes all the everybodies of eccentric performers in different arts, sciences, and sports are in this great inventory. Just to read the book, it reminds you of all kinds of things that happened over the last 60 years that are the dustbin of what all these people attempted to do. They all tried to be a Donald Trump. And then Trump shows up as an afterimage of it, a clarity of it, after it's not ground anymore, or when it's obsolete. See, Trump was showing the obsolescence of so many things, of all the dropout postures everybody did. So he was a curious, what would you say, a double duty interrobang of himself before he became president. And then when he was president, nobody can define what the hell happened. Because it was a nothing. Now that gets into your nihilism. How would you relate to Nietzsche, to this nihilism of his presidency?
Well, I mean, I like what you were just suggesting a moment ago, and that was that Trump exposed the nihilization of everything.
Yeah.
So when Trump becomes president, what he exposes is the nullity of the presidency.
Yeah.
Which is a catastrophic event in history, right? The catastrophe in Greek is the turning over of the furrow when you're plowing a field.
Yes.
Right? So the by exposing the nullity of all things, Trump was identifying where we're at, and was, of course, eliciting all kinds of outraged cries against
panic, hysteria, schizophrenia,
absolutely,
and paranoia and ecstasy.
All of the above. Well, not too much ecstasy.
Oh, no, no. The Trump followers, the rallies and
yeah,
that.
If you want to include them, yes.
Yeah.
I was thinking of the anti-Trumpers or the never-Trumpers.
No. No, they were the other four.
You're right. The response came from the whole spectrum of HCE.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And in a certain way, that's what Trump was. You could say that he was like a prism, and the light goes into the prism and then comes out as the spectrum,
yes,
of color.
And that's what Trump realized, my tiny note chart.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to bring out a minute ago that when you were talking about the presidents and then when you were talking about everything that happened after 2000 and the unshackled dustbin, all of these things are reminiscent of the tiny note chart.
Yeah.
They're either already included in it or they're things that you could include in it if you updated it.
Yes, and one of the authors of Unshackled, Scott Woods, does mention Dave and I as people. He learned a lot in our discussions by email or whatever that helped him figure out how to do the book. So I'm actually quoting a book that I had a part in, inspired. But this person, we were on an email, small 10 people, circle emailing through the Trump years after they produced this brilliant book, and Trump was too much for him. He couldn't take Trump. It got worse, and he eventually got quite pissed off at Dave, who was sort of pro-Trump or didn't like the animosity to him. So the guy didn't survive his own book. Are you there?
I'm here. So is the guy that wrote the book, is he a Toronto guy?
Yeah, and a very good childhood friend of Dave Neufeld. And they he produced the book in 2016 or so. Then Trump gets elected. Then he doesn't know what to really – he can't – it's stretching his ability to be a person. What Trump is doing is violating everything. And so he and Dave got in a big argument, went on for years, and they eventually sort of lost their friendship. We heard Trump cause this all over the place among friends. But the guy who made a brilliant book about Trump couldn't take Trump even though he kind of thought he understood Trump. He couldn't take it. And he couldn't take Dave's not being so upset by Trump as Scott was. So that was an interesting side effect that happened after the book, which go ahead.
Well, it identifies one of the things that you're trying to do in the book, and that is you're trying to open up a space where a value judgment or an aesthetic judgment is not exercised.
Yeah.
Right? What you're trying to do is you're trying to say what's going on here, and you're trying to take the widest possible perspective, and that means appreciating this, what we are just calling the prismatic phenomenon of Trump.
Yeah. So I say many smart and ambitious people have even become president, but they never had the autonomous medium like Twitter to present a program for our perceptual edification. Trump has realized this opportunity to present challenges to our very organs of sensory apprehension rather than just to the world of ideas and social reform. All shamans, gurus, and seers attempt to reveal environments that their fellow motivated somnambulists aren't noticing. In a world of multitudinous claims from conflicting cultures, memes, and values, most presidents withdraw from providing an anti-environment. Most presidents withdraw from providing an anti-environment to the Android meme and do nothing. Now, Nelson had a recording of McLuhan in class around 1974 and 75, and he was explaining, if you were actually president of the United States, there's so much you're involved in, so many environments that you represent, that you could do nothing but nothing. You could only do nothing. And that's what I'm thinking of here. Most presidents withdraw from providing an anti-environment to the Android meme and do nothing. And they never thought of using the most powerful cliche environment in the world to bypass social engineering issues, moral issues, or ethical issues, and engage citizens on a level of sensory challenge. The plateau of great artists and scientists from Picasso, Einstein, and Frank Zappa to Mae Brussels, Marsha McLuhan, and Dr. Carol Dean. I stuck in my bride. To the cathartic school, this seems an irresponsible abandonment of duty and commitment to honored institutional purposes, as expressed in a recent broadcast of Morning Joe. And I would just take a link of any Morning Joe, because they were always having problems with Trump.
Still are.
Yeah.
I don't watch it, but every once in a while I see some quotation of what
the woman
Barbara had said that day.
Yeah. And
so,
I just noticed my link is not there, but I have a footnote. Maybe the footnote. Oh, it's probably down on the footnote.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Joe, I don't even remember his name. Joe and his
Barbara.
What?
Joe Scarborough.
Barbara?
No, Scarborough.
Oh, Scarborough, right. And the woman was, I think they got married. She was the big new Brzezinski's daughter. And,
right.
And in a book by a McLuhanite in England who got access to the KGB files, a very interesting book showing how the KGB and the CIA studied McLuhan going back to the 50s. And Brzezinski was a McLuhanite, and he made a famous quote, which I don't remember right now, but it showed him understanding the techno-president phenomenon that was coming. She's on there, not able to – she has her father should have taught her some McLuhan stuff that he knew about. So she'd get out of her ethical view of everything. Because I say that she and Joe, with all their sneering ethical superiority, note how they missed the probing and prompting by Trump in a style they regard as trivial. But new art always appears ugly. And Trump, the paramedium maven, has created a new role in the Beltway bubble that bypasses the percipients, classifying hasty accusations. Now, this is a line from the end of Ancient Quarrel of Modern America, the last essay in Interior Landscape, in an essay he wrote in 1946, The Ancient Quarrel of Modern America, where McLuhan was criticizing how basically debate was a hasty accusation, and then met with a warm rejoinder. If you look it up, you'll see. I'm saying he bypassed the percipients classifying hasty accusation, and warm rejoinder of the alt-left, alt-center, and even the alt-right. So that was a pretty interesting embed I made right out of McLuhan.
Right. So let me just make a few remarks about that. The McLuhan's Ancient Quarrel, which is a phrase that appears in his thesis, is of the three trivial arts. And so, and that ends in 1600.
Yes.
Goes from 2500, goes 2500 years from 500 BC to the year, I'm sorry, goes to
2000
years.
Yeah.
From 400 to 1600.
Yeah.
So then he, but McLuhan believed that it didn't stop then, that debate, it kept going into modern America.
Yes.
So in 1944, actually, he already gave a lecture on the continuation of his thesis. And that 1944 lecture in St. Louis then was published in January of 46 in the Classical Journal. So when he's talking about the warm rejoinder there, what he's talking about is the way that academics and the way media actually go about their business. No real issues are enjoined.
Yeah.
There's just, he said that and she said this and he said this and she said that again, and you can make a whole career out of that. That's,
yeah.
That's what basically what modern America is, right?
Yeah, the talking heads.
Yeah, that's right. And so one of the things that people were looking for,
Oh, okay, you blipped out. What's happening there?
And when?
Wait, we missed a few words, so do that again. So what we're witnessing,
People were looking for an end to the talking heads, the he said, she
yeah.
said phenomenon, right? And so Trump's... you're fired is the kind of executive decision that people were looking for on another level. They were looking for an end to the bullshit that was going on night and day.
Yeah. No more new, just opinion. And nihilistically going on.
Oh, yeah, amounting to nothing, for sure.
I mean, that's what McLuhan, why he recommended turning off the TV environment. He saw the nihilism that would come as TV exhausted its opportunities or imagination of content. You know, they were exhausted by, let's say, 1980, but what kinds of TV to make? Maybe even exhausted by 1970.
Yeah. I don't know that McLuhan was worried about repetition. He recognized that everything is repetition, in a sense, and that's why retrieval is important.
Yeah,
and why instant replay is important, because it comes to some kind of understanding about that. But McLuhan said that TV was the first medium of tactility. And what he meant by that is that in order to understand TV, you have to be able to connect the dots. And connecting the dots is sort of what being human is all about. So if you, the TV had two possibilities, either you could be horrified by the lack of connection between the dots, or you could take advantage
of the lack of connection between the dots and understand what was going on. So from 1970, let's say, until now, 50 years, all we've had is the horror.
Right.
We've had no connecting of the dots.
Well, you know how people say Newton brought in a new image of the brain or of cognition with the clock. Mm-hmm. And the universe. And you could look at each technological phase that humans turn into a metaphor for their cognitive processes. And then when the computer took over, it was people started talking about downloading this and that. So the content of the computer became metaphors for people's cognitive processes. But you just brought a point here. McLuhan said that when you watch TV, you have to make a pattern out of the dots. You got to connect the dots. And then that phrase has become such a major term in the world of hasty accusation and warm rejoinder that it's a good example of people becoming what they behold, and it becomes a metaphor of the cognitive process everybody has to engage in. Everybody has to make
That's
the
right.
news. Everybody has to connect the dots. It may be social status is based on your ability to connect the dots.
Yep.
In a world where McLuhan said the only job is to keep up with knowing, that means connecting the dots. And, of course, more and more each decade unfolded, people were connecting the dots to nothing, of nothing, from nothing, and giving up on pattern recognition and bothering to connect the dots. So it became a scarce commodity, connecting the dots. I mean, I've always, when I meet people that I talk to go on the beach, if they're pissed off at the general, here comes everybody, they'll say, nobody's connecting the dots. That is the most common complaint I hear. Of course, I don't go into how you're quoting McLuhan. I just think about it myself.
But, Bob, I'd be interested to hear how a sample itinerary goes when you go to the beach. Do you just go from group to group and talk to people that are down there?
It's quite a story.
Fire away.
I have not told you. I've told several people this recently. You have not heard what I'm going to say, I assume. Okay. I've been living here for 13 years. It'll be 13 years in June. Going to the beach pretty well every day. Going in the water, except for Tuesdays and Thursdays where I do my radio show and I have to get back no time to get in the water. But I walk every day and swim five of those days. Now, it's been very busy all these 13 years until COVID. When COVID happened, there was nobody on the walkway, hardly anybody. And it's a 35-minute walk to where I go in the water. And
that's the walkway?
Yeah, it's along the beach path. I mean, I go down through a golf course, wonderful environment, and then I get down to the beach, and then I have to walk perpendicular, 90-degree angle, along the water. I walk down, and then I turn left, and it's, 80% of it.
Like a bike path or something?
Yeah, it's a walk path. It's along the beaches in front of the hotels. It's a beautiful mm-hmm. walk. Incredible. And, you're looking at the waves and that. You're very close to the ocean, yet you're on a cement walkway. So I was anonymous for 12 years, just another guy. What is that? What if God was just another one of us? What's that song? Another slob on the bus. And but when I went in the water, I did what no one else did. I swam. I did long-distance swimming. I'd swim for 45 minutes, do laps up and down this long beach, whereas everybody else is attempting to surf or boogie board or bounce up and down. Nobody swims, especially long distance. So I'd come out of the water like once every 2 months through the years. I'd walk up onto the beach, different kinds of crowdedness, but people would start applauding. They noticed me swimming, right? And they were very impressed with what I was doing. But there is nobody asked who I was or anything. They just applauded and appreciated the performance. But then when there was nobody on the walkway and there was just people who were living here, no more tourists, those people would end up at the end of the walkway and see me swimming, and then I'd bump into them in coming back or something, and they would note me. They'd say, "You're the guy who's doing that swimming," and they'd compliment me. So I got to know them, and because they'd be the only ones I'd bump into, and I wasn't a nobody in a huge crowd of walkers, right? I was visible. Which I didn't want to have. I hate having to say hello to somebody every fucking day. You know what I mean? Because I feel obliged to say something witty or interesting, but I can't be bothered to think up something. Anyways, after a while, people were very there's about four couples that I would meet and in the late afternoon, and they started to say, "Oh, how come you're so healthy?" So I told them about our products, and they got on our products, and they were incredible. I mean, they got incredible effects. So now I'm a hero, and when I walk home from the beach, I bump into three or four of the couples. It's a, what do you call it? I use the term, a waiting line. A waiting line? I think that's what it is. I use the phrase all the time. A greeting line. I have to stop and talk. This is the worst. I never wanted this at all. It makes me get home too late. But I have a greeting line. And I got to talk to them, and they tell me about what's going on with the effects of the products. So
you didn't realize that there were strings attached to the products.
Well, what do you mean by strings? How are strings? What?
Well, you've been captured. You've been
yes.
Tied by the.
I got trapped by my own environment. I was making an environment, and it circled back and trapped me. And I'm genuinely, I'm being genuine here how I don't want to talk to people. But it is interesting to talk to them, and because it's about my products or Carolyn's products. So I've now have people, there was the four couples, they're the anchor. But now they have friends come and visit them. So they'll introduce me to their friend. And then the friend will want to walk and talk with me. So I've become a guru on the way home. It is so ridiculous.
This is like Larry David's
critique
of meet and greet.
Yeah, meet
right?
and greet.
The worst thing that can happen to you is meet and greet.
Yeah. So it's funny that you picked up that I had a story there. You wanted to hear about this phenomenon. Well, it's become pretty funny. And, of course, they all want to meet Carolyn, but she walks in the morning. So they started walking in the morning to bump into Carolyn. So it's hilarious. So I have this whole social life based on walking home from the beach. And there's a lot more to say about it, I guess. But now the tourists are back. So that doesn't help anymore. Everybody knows me now of the core greeting line. So they look for me in the crowd of tourists. So I can't hide anymore. So, okay, that's a digression, right?
Good one.
Yeah, manipulative digression. Let's see. So I end up saying, as a result, in this, my note of 2017, as a result of what you are hearing described here first, I regard President Trump as the greatest artist/scientist paramedia ecologist alive today. So is that manipulating? Am I exaggerating? Not really. But, of course, most people see it as ridiculous exaggeration. And I put that out. That's on the Internet for the last 4 years. Nobody ever commented on it. Nobody. None of the McLuhanites. Nobody even read it, maybe. But now, if they're interested in this new book, they might read it. So That's phase one, okay? And you've done a good job of translating what I'm trying to say about Trump, what an interesting phenomenon he was. And probably he'll come back in some form, because what we have now is the most incredible nihilism ever, where a guy didn't even run, and he can't talk, and he doesn't exist. And what other crazy things about him? In an election that maybe was rigged, a total nihilistic act is Mr. Biden. So if people become their names, are we waiting on waiting? Are we biding our time with Biden? What does his name mean?
Well, I don't know, but it, what you just said is interesting in terms of what we were saying before, where Trump exposed the nothingness of the presidency. If Biden is a nothing, then he's living what Trump exposed.
Yeah. Every president's always an evolution, a progression or a change or a new wrinkle is added, every one of them. And so you had to out-nothing the nothing that trumped us all. We were all trumped by Trump. He was a Trump leal. So you have to have a blatant, ridiculous nothing. And who would have believed that a guy could become president by not campaigning? and when he has a press conference, everybody just hopes that he can say a sentence or two. This is pretty extreme nothingness going on here.
Yeah. So, I mean, you were just saying that he became president by not campaigning, and that's right. But that turning campaigning on its ass has meaning, right? I can't think of a way of expressing it at the moment.
No, it's the new version of the dark horse. Remember, Trudeau got in. McLuhan said in the late 60s, you got to be a dark horse to even be a potential candidate. You can't want the job. You actually run from it. And so Biden is extremely not wanting the job. He refused to campaign for it. We're talking about a dark horse.
I guess, but what McLuhan meant by a dark horse was the personality has to kind of recede into the distance. Can't be something that is too upfront.
Yeah,
like
not
Nixon,
hot.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can't be a hot image.
But in a certain way, Biden is hot. Right? He's... Biden is caught up in this moral ascendancy that...
Well, he's trying to be something after
absolutely.
The Trump nothingness.
Correct.
And he
correct.
Can, and you can't do it.
That's right.
You
he
can't
exposes,
do it.
By attempting to be, he exposes the not to be in a way even better than Trump.
That's right. And everybody says he's brought... He's trying to bring unity. He's brought peace from his nothingness. He's brought a calmness to public life. And now news is fainting and disappearing because they got nothing to write about. No nothing to be nothing about.
That's right. Although occasionally, like a million times a day, they still find something to say about Trump.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Because Trump is their oxygen.
Yeah.
Right? But what you were saying earlier about, I mean, just a second ago about Biden is interesting. You were saying that in a certain way, Biden is trumping Trump.
Yeah, by trying to be something. Every new president had to, in this sequence since Eisenhower, had to trump the previous guys. But I'm not going to go back into it. Yeah, so he's trying to trump Trump. And he does it by out-nothingness, by claiming he's doing something. finally, we've restored peace in our society, and we can come together. But, of course, he can't see anything coming together, so he hides. And people wait for the lady to become president. I mean, how crazy can you get for a political process? Talk about being involved in the image. Yeah. Everybody's trying to arrive at a post-Trump something, and it's pretty hard to do. And if this guy can't meet the challenge, they'll put in the vice president, who's got a manic laugh that people find disturbing.
Yeah,
the hyena.
But the fact that she's a woman, the fact that she's a woman of color, the fact that she's got vague Caribbean roots, and,
yeah.
Canadian roots even, all of these things fit
she
her.
Needs. She needs that.
Hmm?
All those things she needs to be viable.
That's right. But a minute ago you said, you know, what an end to the political process. But this, it's not just an end to the political process. It's Western civilization has come to this.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, for us to sit here and laugh about this sort of stuff is a little bit like what McLuhan was saying we had to do. Right, he was. McLuhan said, "Unless you're able to step back and laugh at this sort of stuff, you cannot realize what it is."
Right. He said somewhere in the end, "Shall we laugh or cry?" was the name of an article, I think, in the TV Guide. Shall we laugh or cry? That was our dilemma, and I guess we go for the laughing,
the laugh side. That's right.
Yeah. And the Biden team is crying. The Trumpers, Trump's laughing. You know, he continues. He got interviewed the other day. I didn't watch it, but he got interviewed by his daughter-in-law. Okay, talk about, you know, keeping it within the cabal, or keeping it within the family, all in the family, for his big interview. He hasn't had one in a while. It's an inside job, right?
Yeah.
He gets his daughter-in-law to interview him. I mean, this is, you know, at the end of War and Peace of Global Village, page 190, about the outbreeding and the inbreeding. Do you remember that thing? That the, mammals, microorganisms inbreed, mammals outbreed. But then media took over the mammalian role, so media outbreeds. And man, humans and nature together, or animals, they became inbreeders because the media became the new animals, the new outbreeders. Okay, that's what he says at the end. So as part of this inbreeding, incestuous situation, you have the guy interviewed by his daughter. I mean, nobody would have thought. No way would Eisenhower be interviewed by his daughter, right? But the inbreeding factor of media, animals, and nature, and humans has become what we're witnessing with Trump. And he continues to say that the election was nothing. It was rigged. He won, and that's that. Of course, the regular media will say, what an idiot, he's gone nuts, but he sticks to it. What an impasse on so many levels of communication. Nobody can connect.
So I didn't read that, or I didn't listen to the
interview
either. But I pulled it up on your website here. And one of the interesting things to me is that he's in a room that looks like the Tsar's palace or something.
Oh, yeah?
It's all got gold leaf.
Well, that would be his office.
probably. But it's like saying, an interview with the Pharaoh. Or an interview with the last czar or something.
The last, what, does it say something you're saying?
No, the background certainly says something.
Oh, I see. The interview with the last Did you say czar?
Yeah. Pharaoh or Caesar.
Yeah, there was a book in the 90s, a postmodern book, about every president since Reagan was a Chinese emperor. And it was talking about the last Chinese emperor. That's right. McLuhan-esque. You know, the West goes completely east, and every president is a Chinese emperor, whatever that means to people, not American. So, yeah, your point about a pharaoh and that is what Trump is. He's a president, he's an emperor, and he's not an American emperor. He's something else.
Yeah.
You know, it
poses the question of not only what he is, but what we are.
Yes. And in the Burroughs article, McLuhan reviews Burroughs in 64, he says we're all becoming Egyptian or pharaonic, and we're doing that with Web 2.0. Everybody has their own empire, their media empire. And so they're pharaonic, and they tune the whole world. That's what he says Joyce did with Finnegan's Wake, and McLuhan did it with the title Center for Culture and Technology. He was tuning the whole world.
Mm-hmm. And what that means is that it was a do-it-yourself phenomenon. And so then the question arises, what's the difference between a do-it-yourself phenomenon like Joyce or McLuhan and the do-it-yourself Web 2.0 that you were just talking about? Western civilization more or less comes down to that question.
Yep. Who would have believed that the chaos of Finney's Wake would become people's communicating lives? We live Finney's Wake now, literally.
Yep.
A page of Finney's Wake would. And that wasn't obvious to people or even Joyce scholars. You couldn't probably really begin to see that until the 90s with email, because there's so much all through Finney's Wake, there's endless something said, something respond, or said, response, said, response. It goes on for pages, you know what I mean? And he even has the word emailia in there, E-M-A-I-L-I-A, emailia. He named what we became. And then the Web 2.0 is even more chaotic or pharaonic or incredible. So only the last, 10 years can we really see how Finney's Wake was a report on the present that McLuhan said great art always did. He couldn't have said that 40 years ago. You see that? See, well, McLuhan only brings it up to TV, but the whole internet is in Finney's Wake.
Now, as I've said before, I don't know Finnegan's Wake well enough to talk about it.
Okay, well.
But I do agree that in the present circumstance, both McLuhan and Joyce are becoming clear in a way they did not and perhaps could not before.
Yeah, and I'm trying to do is to update McLuhan to show that the McLuhan industry's got no clue about what McLuhan did or accomplished. And I don't know what to say. You should scan a bit ahead and just see what you see and ask me. We get to this point where I go, my goal is to show the phases. The Global Village, McLuhan, the Global Theater, and then the Global Membrane, or Android Meme Phase 1, Android Meme Phase 2, then the Anthropomorphic Physical, then the Tech Body. That's what I'm now going to do after I did the 2017 background.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now I'm going to go back to events in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and work my way back up to Trump.
Right. Maybe what I could do is point out how, I think it was in 1949, but it was around 1950 at any rate, Levi Strauss wrote an essay on what anthropology is. It's in structure. It's in the book Structural Anthropology, and McLuhan was certainly familiar with it. When he became familiar with it, I'm not sure. But what Levi-Strauss does is he differentiates between the task of the historian and the task of the anthropologist. And he says that both of them are going along the same road, and they work together. And the historian takes the facts that everybody can see and gives their intrinsic meaning. So you have the for the historian, you have the extrinsic facts, and then you have the intrinsic meaning. And I take it that that's what you do in your book.
Yep.
What I do, in contrast, I take the what Levi-Strauss calls the anthropologic view, and that is to take the particular, that is to say the extrinsic thing, and to give it its universal meaning. And its universal meaning isn't some sort of, the final meaning of the universe or something.
Mm.
It's the HCE meaning, that all things are the realization of some potential, and the potential lies along a spectrum of potentialities. So the anthropologic view is to take the particular and locate it as a realization along the spectrum of possibilities.
Yeah.
So what I see us doing is dialoguing between these two tasks of the historian and the anthropologist.
Yeah.
What we will do is we will continue in continuing with the book, is that you will be exposing what you take to be the intrinsic message of Trump, and I will be trying to take the particulars of the Trump story, but also the particulars of your narrative, and try to show where they're located on the spectrum of possibilities.
Great. Okay, that sounds commendable. How would you begin? As you look through the quotes and that I first start with, I get into the Orwellian and the obsolescence of Orwell in 1984. And mm-hmm. that's, maybe some people have noticed that now, but nobody knew about it 30, 40 years ago. So that's like the Global Village era, the Global Village of the 40s and 30s. Well, he even said 1984, the book was about 1934. So the Global Village brings in the Orwellian aspects of what had already been going on back then, rather than us waiting for an amazing Orwellian scene coming around the corner under Biden or Trump or Bush or Reagan, just going back, you know, all the horrible presidents everybody got worried about. But no, that was way back in the 30s, the Global Village. So that's where I begin.
Mm-hmm. So this is, you could say that the Global Village is not something that develops in time. It's what's already there.
Yeah.
Right. And so the what the moral interpretation of events tries to do is constantly try to catch up with what's happening. But you can't catch up with what's happening if what's happening is already there.
Yeah.
Right? Because you're trying to leap ahead where there is no leaping ahead. Right? So with the Orwellian aspects, what Nietzsche could already see in the 19th century and what McLuhan could see starting in the 1940s and until he died in 1980, is the authoritarian aspects of human ingenuity. That we think we're on a path to freedom, and in fact, people wrote endless articles about the human path to freedom. Sort of, I would say that was between 1945 and 1985. That was the great way to make a buck.
Yep.
To write a book or article about advancing human freedom or some stupid thing like that.
Right. Now, so for younger people who might have heard of 1984, we don't know what they are taught, what they're told in school anymore. But the...
They certainly haven't read it.
Yeah, they wouldn't have read it. Might have saw the movie. But the thing is, I'm saying, look, what you think is coming or happening now happened a long time ago, and this guy noticed that more than anybody else. So I'm trying to show, begin with, look at this significant percept that this thinker made that you don't even know about and probably don't believe. And didn't know that it was that bad back then. So that's, as I look at the quotes I picked, that was a theme I wanted to point out. The obsolescence of the Orwellian.
Perceptions that emerge with Trump are conscious to him. Or do you think that these are perceptions that sort of come through Trump almost like a stained glass window or something?
Yeah, and that'll be more obvious when I get into the tech body.
Uh-huh, okay.
You see, Trump is the tech body or a big aspect of it, or he can't bypass being the tech body.
Mm-hmm.
It's
mm-hmm.
got him. It'll use him however way it wants.
So maybe one way to approach this would be to go to Trump as the tech body, that is to say, go to the latter part of your book.
Yeah.
And then once that's clarified, go back to the steps that you took to explain it through McLuhan's career.
Yeah, like the detective story.
Yeah,
we find out who did it, and then explain how we got there, how we found out
Correct.
Who did it.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah. So I don't know if that appeals to you. We could. That's what we could start next week. Whatever method you would be most comfortable with is fine with me.
Well, I want you to ask me questions as much as possible. I don't know what to select. I've done pretty good just scanning and said, well, I could talk about that and this, but I want to see what you notice, what you appreciate.
Uh-huh.
So you might actually have to prepare a bit for this more than me and read a little bit to see what you notice.
All right. Well, of course, I've already read the book or the brochure several times, and I've marked it up in various ways.
Oh, okay.
So what I can certainly do, starting next time, is I can say, well, let's look at pages, you know.
Yeah, and look at what you marked up, and you can start at the end. Start at the tech body part.
Start with the tech body. Should we do that? Okay.
Yeah.
That's fine.
As long as you asked me to lead, I don't see how to lead this. I'm interested in what the effects are on you.
Gotcha. Plus, you're a very busy guy, Bob. This is a fairly minor aspect of your cosmic activity.
That's right. Well, you know, on every Wednesday, I do a five-hour dialogue on the radio before I come to you. Plus, I have to answer all my fans down on the walkway. In between. So it's funny.
Well,
for me, the COVID exposed me. Really did.
To your immediate neighbors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And these people must be, retired insurance executives and stuff like that, right?
Oh, well, some are younger. No, there's a few younger people, but I'd say two couples are in their 70s and three couples are in their 40s.
And people in their 40s must still be working at something, right?
As a matter of fact, one of them lives in New York and came over here March a year ago, got stranded here. And so then stopped worrying about their career because everything shut down and just relaxed. But now, a year later, she's gone back to New York and may not see her for a couple of months. But she, her whole career was interrupted. And she was stranded here in paradise.
Now she's, tough life.
Yeah, now she's back to hell, New York City. So yeah, that's the changes are, I am seeing the effects on people because I don't have anybody to interact with, right? I'm a self-employed, self-involved situation here. Very busy, but it's all on the telephone and that. No people. I'm not in an office or anything. And so my office now is out there, and that's what COVID brought me, a kind of a daily social life that I didn't have.
Yeah.
A neighborhood.
Yeah.
I'm a mystery man in a compound here. I don't relate to anybody. I don't talk to anybody. I don't want them to find out what I'm doing. If any of them heard me, what I say on the radio, there'd be trouble. So there's many people don't believe Carolyn has a husband. She claims she has a husband, but they've never seen him. So that's pretty neat. Carolyn gave a talk in a person's house, and a guy showed up, a man, who was there just to meet me. He assumed I'd be there, but I wasn't, because I knew that they'd be taking advantage of it. But he failed to meet me, and then shortly after he moved out. He gave up and left.
Well, it's to me, the stories of the beach and the walkway and all this sort of stuff are interesting because it's the extreme opposite of your cosmic activities.
That's right.
Broadcasting.
I'm discarnately in touch with with millions, but that's physically, right. Chemical body is isolated.
Yeah.
I'm going to send you the link to my old website, and you can look at the pictures of my walkway. You can see my walk.
All right.
Yeah, very nice pictures that we took, back in 2009 or so. The sequence, you'll see what I walk along and what I experience, which is pretty nice.
Good. So let's just briefly discuss for next time. If I understand you correctly, we're going to go to the end.
Yeah.
And I'm going to review. Should we specify the chapters I'm going to review so that
we're always going off anyways onto other unforeseen parts. No, you're just going to talk about what you noted. You made notes.
Okay.
All right. Use those as springboards.
Okay, good. And then you'll respond.
Yeah. And then maybe, then that might give me a focus, and then maybe I could start looking at other quotes and finding stuff.
Good.
That I wouldn't find unless I was prompted. Okay, so very good. We arrived safely at the end, and you can proceed with your day.
All right. You too, Bob. Thank you very much.
Okay, great talking to Cameron.
Same here, Bob.
Bye-bye. All right, bye.